Hello, this is Julianne Good, and this is Psych 101. We are here to make psychology understandable and here with tips to make your life easier and the lives of your family and friends, because that's what we want nowadays, right? Something to make our lives a little bit easier. It's a little complicated right now, isn't it? Anyways, tonight my special guest is Venerable Miao Shi of the Fo Guan Shan Shi Lai Temple in Hacienda Heights, California. I know the Venerable from attending the Buddhist temple. She is a wonderful woman and very marvelous at speaking, so I'm really honored to have her on tonight. And a little bit about the Venerable. She is a Buddhist nun with the Fo Guan Shan Buddhist Order, and she has served for 4 years as the editor-in-chief of the English pages of the Merit Times in America, a daily newspaper, and the director of both the Fo Guan Shan International Translation Center and the Buddhist Light Publishing in America for 3 years. She is responsible for translating the works of Venerable Master Xian Yong into English, and her translated works include 7 volumes of the series Between Ignorance and Enlightenment and the 2 volumes of Dharma Words. Currently, she is one of the directors of Fo Guan Shan Shi Lai Temple in Hacienda Heights, in charge of cultural and educational activities, interfaith work, and community outreach. She is also the planner and one of the teachers of the temple's English Buddhism classes. Born and raised in Hong Kong, Venerable Miao Shi holds a bachelor's degree in commerce from Simon Fraser University in Vancouver, British Columbia, in Canada, and has lived in Canada for 20 years before becoming a nun and serving in the Shi Lai Temple. Hello, Venerable. How are you?
Hello. How are you, Julianne? Thank you. Good.
Wonderful. I'm so happy to have you on.
Oh, I'm happy to be with you on the air.
Yeah. So my first question to you, is Buddhism a religion or a philosophy?
Well, it's a question asked by not just Westerners, but by, I think, people around the world who has learned a little bit or read a little bit about Buddhism, or, well, maybe even more. And actually, Buddhism can be everything. You can consider it a way of life, a philosophy for life. And of course, I think for many Buddhists, it's a religion. And actually, I think for religion, it can be everything for a lot of people. So religion can be a philosophy for some people as well, I'm sure.
Yes, it depends on which way you approach it, most definitely.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm.
So now, the Shi Lai Temple, how long has that been in existence?
Well, a lot of people ask the question as well. You know, when they're here and they look at the buildings, they say, oh, so how long have you guys been here? And I say, well, we've been open in 88. And everybody hearing that, most of them, I would say, would be very surprised that we've been around for more than 25 years now.
Yes, and it's a beautiful temple in Hacienda Heights.
Just
to go there and to be on the grounds is just so peaceful. And I know every time that I go, there are so many visitors from so many different nationalities. It's incredible.
Yes. When you look at like an Asian face or a Western face, you can never tell where they're from. So we have people from across the country. We have people from South America, Australia, Europe, and you'll be surprised, you know, if you really ask our visitor, where are you from? It's really quite international.
It is. It's wonderful. And the home temple is in which country?
It's in Taiwan, in southern Taiwan, in a region called Kaohsiung. And it's this is where my teacher, my master, started out in southern Taiwan.
Now, did you start learning about Buddhism when you were up in Canada? How was your travels getting to a Buddhist path and becoming a nun?
It's actually quite interesting. I started out, of course, I was born and raised in Hong Kong, as you just mentioned earlier. And of course, back then, in Hong Kong, was Buddhism has always been a part of life, you know, but I never really get to know much about it, or you know, just very, very little knowledge of Buddhism back then when I was young, because I went to a Catholic school for my basic education. And after that, of course, I went to Canada for my college. And actually, that's where I started to come into contact to learn about Buddhism. And actually, this was when the time when Fo Guangshan built a branch temple there. And that's how I entered our order, Fo Guangshan.
And going from a business world into being a Buddhist nun, how did that path occur?
Well, it was quite natural, actually. I was kind of, you know, I was into business in a sense, yes. And just picking up Buddhism and getting more and more interested in it. And for a lot of people, you know, it seems very difficult because, you know, to let go of the, what we call the worldly life, you know, the mundane life. But for me, it was quite natural is to focus on my own practice. It's, of course, it's a personal path for everyone. And actually, my wish and vow was to do a lot of translation because I realized that not many things that that my master had written, you know, it was kind of still budding. You know, our translation center was kind of budding. And I think I can dedicate myself to do translation back then. And that's how I just, you know, just took that up.
And how old were you when you made the transition?
I was like in my early 40s, early mid-40s, yes.
Mm-hmm. Wow, that's amazing. It is. Because, you know, you just hear stories about a lot of people who make that transition like when they're in their late teens, early 20s. You know, it's always that in-between time developmentally that people make that leap of faith. So I think that's wonderful that you did it in your 40s.
Yeah, because I think when people are more mature, they know what they want. They know, you know, the later part of my life, okay, would be definitely what I wanted to do. You know, I dedicate all my years in doing that. But I think when we were young, especially in college or even in high school, you know, you just no clue. You know, you were just adventurous. You want to try things. You were interested in taking different paths and explore. So I think by middle age, I think for a lot of people, it would be a very... It's a choice that you make with your eyes open, let's say it that way.
Right. That's a great way of stating it. It's like with me, too, with, you know, dedicating the last part of my life to psychology. I made that switch.
Right.
I knew I wanted to do it when I was in my teens, but I had so many obstacles in my way. And then I finally got to the point where the opportunity presented itself. I'm going, okay, this is it. This is what I want to do. This is my soul calling, and I need to do this.
Right, yes. I think a lot of people would make choices in the middle ages and like in the middle years, you know, and they know that this is what I want to do with, you know, the rest of my life. I think this is something that was my interpretation back then. That was my my reason and choice.
Yeah, and it's you know, really, I think when you have a soul calling, you need to just go answer it. It doesn't make any difference what age you're at. It should not be an obstacle in your way, correct?
So true, so true. It's like a lot of people, when they retire from their career, they have a second career. They like to do, maybe it's a hobby that they loved all the time but could not, like, do full-time. You know, so now that I don't have to have a day job, you know, I don't have to work anymore, they turn to their hobby and turn to what they want to do. And I think that's something that a lot of people can resonate with.
Yeah, exactly. You need to go with your passion. That's it. Most definitely.
True.
Yes. So we're going to get back to Buddhism here.
Yeah.
So can you give the listening audience a short history of the of how Buddhism came into play?
Well, you know, Buddhism, of course, came from the word Buddha. Buddha, of course, is a Sanskrit word, but I think Buddhism is an English word. Buddha means the enlightened one. And, of course, the Buddha, or actually, when the Buddha was born, he wasn't born as a Buddha. He was born as a prince, Prince Siddhartha. I'm sure a lot of people have read about his story. And he was born in what, Nepal today, but I think back there, more than 2,500 years ago, it was considered ancient India. So he was born a prince, and he lived a very privileged life. He was married, actually. He had a young boy, a young son, and he was out. He was looking or seeking desperately, kind of almost like for the truth, so to speak, because his father sheltered him. Because when he was born, it was according to the custom, somebody kind of told a fortune, said your son, you know, may leave home, renounced, and became enlightened one, or someone who is, you know, back then they didn't call it Buddha, of course, when he was young. And it says, no, there's like two choices, two paths that he might take, either be a very wonderful king or be like a spiritual leader of some sort. So his father was very afraid and sheltered him from any kind of real life outside the palace. But eventually he found out, and he wanted to seek what we call the liberation, okay, from the cycle of living and dying, from, you know, being born and aging and getting sick, or you've got aging, sickness, and death, okay? And he practiced, he left home, and he practiced what the, back then it was the practice of asceticism. It was still, I think they're still there in India today even. It was kind of prevalent for what we call practitioners or shamans to do that. But he realized that torturing his physical body could not attain liberation. So he finally kind of came back a little bit, okay, from his asceticism, and he meditated. He meditated, according to legend, he meditated for 49 days. And he attained the truth. And of course, in that meantime, he was tested by what we call the Mara, or it's like, you know, demons of the mind, or even, you know, actual demons trying to stop him to attain enlightenment. And he attained enlightenment, and he attained what we call supreme enlightenment, and that was the name Buddha means the enlightened one. And he started to teach the path, what we call the path to enlightenment, and he taught for 49 years all across India. And of course, he walked back then, you know, there's no other means of travel. And after he passed on, his disciples compiled and gathered all his teachings and started to spread them out to Asia, and eventually, of course, to China. And China actually had the that Buddhism or the Dharma into China for more than 2,000 years. And from there, it went to Japan and Korea, and eventually, in more modern times, more contemporary times, it would be like about a little over 100 years ago that Buddhism really crossed the ocean and came to this side of the Pacific into America.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of a very brief history. Then, of course, there's another path that Buddhism talk that's going south to Southeast Asia, and with like Vietnam, Thailand, Cambodia, and all those Southeast Asian countries.
So Buddhism still is relatively new in the United States, correct?
I would say so. I mean, of course, nowadays, if you look at 100 years, it's very old. 5 years are old already in the modern times. I think a lot of people would think of 5 years as old, or 10 years as a generation. So yeah, a little over 100 years, and it's still kind of being integrated and into the American culture, into mm-hmm. the Western culture, and what we call localization, or actually it's more like integration and assimilation. Usually, we would say that for a religion to become truly a local religion, it may take maybe any time from 300 to 500 years. But in today's time, because of the internet, because of, you know, the what we call the global village, hopefully it would take shorter. And I think it's already what we call American Buddhism. It's it's kind of obvious now. It's kind of taking shape, really.
And how would you say that form of Buddhism is different from the Buddhism that you learned in Hong Kong or in Canada? What's different?
Well, of course, the Dharma, the teachings are there, but I think it's the way of the practice, how it kind of being adapted and accepted as part of the culture, and how Western practitioners could look at them. And, you know, nowadays, of course, people do things very differently from, say, you know, even 20, 50 years ago, not to speak of 100 or 1,000 years ago. So people would always, I think a lot of the Westerners learning, they're always very curious about the roots of Buddhism. And they may go back to India, they may go to China, they may go to Thailand, Tibet, Japan, and look at the old temples and look at the Asian or the practitioners or what they do or how they do or how they practice. And I'm sure they may find some similarities and also differences.
Yeah, and for all of your years of teaching American Buddhism classes, what do you see that is a common theme of a lot of people searching for something in Buddhism? What is a common factor amongst your students?
I would say most of them, of course, what bring them into Buddhism may be meditation, maybe the concept of even karma, and I think it's a lot of people attracted because of a kind of the lifestyle, the tranquility of Buddhism or the peacefulness of Buddhism. And people coming to classes on a regular basis or for years, I think they find that Buddhism connects with them better in their daily lives. And sometimes people even tell us that Buddhism makes sense to them.
Yeah, and it makes sense without getting too intellectual about it. You know, I mean, it's accessible. To me, I love Buddhism for it being non-judgmental. I think that is the biggest factor that drew me to Buddhism.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure that is also one thing, too. It's one of the big factors. I think also the concept of karma means you have to be responsible. And I think, you know, in many ways, you know, the problems of today's world is that people are just being irresponsible. They do not want to take responsibility for their own lives, for the community, for the families, you know, and so that's why all the problems arise.
Right. It's like not thinking before they do. It's the cause and effect.
Yeah, and then they walk away from it, or they try to deny it, or people try to just cover up or whatever means.
Blame other
so
people.
That is not being responsible, I would say.
No, it is not. Most definitely not. And if the listeners would like to join us in this conversation, the number is 800-893-9562. Again, 800-893-9562. So, Venerable, what teachings of the Buddha would be helpful for people who are having difficulties in life?
Depending on what kind of issues they are dealing with, but I say that if people could truly accept the core concept of Buddhism is called dependent origination, is that, you know, people learn to let go because, you know, things happen because of different reasons and causes and conditions coming together to have it happen. And eventually, this phenomena would kind of slowly kind of go away, okay? So when things are no longer there, learn to let go, whether it can be sadness, it can be pain, it can be a lot of negative emotions. So if you like to step back, you know, take one or two step back and look at it, is it really worth it to be so angry, or is it really worth it to be so painful or have so much hate and anger? Well, we have to think about that. And then, you know, another concept may be the interconnectedness of every being. I mean, we are all connected one to another. So
yes,
in hurting others, we are hurting ourselves.
Yes.
So I think that is also, you know, some of the things people have to kind of realize and accept that, you know, putting out positive energy, being kind, being compassionate, you know, treat people nice, be helpful and not hurtful. Those little things and big things, I think it would create a much better environment, you know, for everyone.
Yes, I agree. And there, you know, once you boil it all down, it is so simple. But for some people, it is so difficult to do those small things. And they have to be reminded somehow that this is what makes life worth living. Really, it puts quality to life.
Yeah, it's kind of open up our hearts to be more big-hearted and more inclusive and more, respectful. You want others to respect you. You have to learn to respect others. So it's mutual.
Yes, what you do will come. Right, yeah. What you do will come back to you, basically.
Exactly, yes.
Yeah. Yeah, I've lived by that one since I was 18. Once I heard that, I was like, oh, that is profound. You know, what you put out, you're going to get back, basically.
Really, yes. I mean, it's something that people cannot accept because, like, you know, if you smile at others enough times, someone will smile back at you.
Yes. That's a beautiful way of stating it. And we're going to take a commercial break. When we come back, I want to talk about mindfulness and meditation. Those are huge right now, okay?
Yes.
All right,
okay.
The Chicago School of Professional Psychology offers numerous psychology, behavioral, and health-related science graduate degrees at 3 campuses, Los Angeles, California, including branches in Westwood and Irvine, Chicago, Illinois, and Washington, D.C., and online. The Chicago School prepares students to meet the ever-changing mental health needs of society through classroom experience and real-world training. The Chicago School Counseling Centers in Irvine and Westwood provide caring, confidential, and affordable psychological services to individuals and their families. For more information, visit thechicagoschool.edu.
And thank you to the Chicago School of Professional Psychology for sponsoring Psych One-on-One. I am back with Venerable Miao Shi, and we are talking about Buddhism and psychology. And before break, we were starting to talk about mindfulness. And from a psychological perspective, I'm going to give you kind of an overview of what mindfulness therapy looks like. It is part of the cognitive behavioral therapy group, which is what a lot of therapists are using now. It has to deal with your thoughts and your behavior and getting in and changing them, going and restructuring how you think and act on things. But with mindfulness therapy, it gets you to accept difficult emotions and thoughts in order to transform them without intention of changing them. And you need to be compassionate about your thoughts and feelings. So again, here comes the non-judgment part of it. And the patient relates to problems with curiosity instead of avoidance, and therefore new options arise for coping and resolving issues when you quiet your mind and still your thoughts. And Venerable, would you like to add anything to that? From a Buddhist perspective, what does mindfulness look like?
It's like to be aware, to be awakened. Oftentimes, we are often blinded. We are blinded by our anger. We are drowned by our sadness, or we are overly delirious over whatever we're too happy about, or, you know, that we are not living in the moment. Actually, mindfulness is, I would put it very simply, is just be focused. So when you know what you're doing, you know what you're speaking, you know what you're thinking, you would make a better choice, a smarter choice, and you would do things better.
So it's be here now.
Yes, be here and now. But it's very difficult. I mean, a lot of people would have like 3 time zones. You know, they're here, they think of what happened, and then they would think of what's going to happen, you know. So, and then we have a lot of speculations of what will happen, or that they have regrets about what they did, and they cannot let go, they beat themselves up, or they keep living, you know, the angry part of it. So it's like people hit you once, but you keep hitting yourself back again and again, because you keep reliving that moment of being hit or being insulted. So, you know, those are things that is wasting our mental resources, is wasting time and energy. So be focused. And that's why I talked about letting go earlier on, is to just let it by, let it go, let it be. You know, it's, if something that you cannot, you know, what's past, you cannot change.
Right.
So just let it be, let it go, and pick yourself up and move on.
Yeah, and maybe also, you know, learn the lessons from the past so that you do not repeat.
That's true. Yes, that's true. But a lot of times you keep repeating mistakes. So, again, there's, when mindfulness come in, you say, oh, okay, I shouldn't be doing it, or I shouldn't be... a lot of people go to classes for anger management. And I think it's funny. Why do we have to manage anger? Just let it go. Throw it away.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to be angry.
Yeah, a lot of people seem angry nowadays, too. They seem very short-fused.
They're very, very short-temper, very upset, because I think people are used to, you know, the internet, instant, everything is fast.
Right.
You know, you have to have it right away. You just have to do it now, and you have to move on, and you have to do so many things all at once, and you're completely distracted. So, you know, that's why distracted driving can be so serious. It's killing. It's murder.
Yeah, dangerous.
Very, very dangerous. Very, yes. Very harmful, you know, to others and to yourself.
And that's a good example. We see that every day, especially out on the roads of L.A.
It's, right.
It's just an everyday
exactly.
occurrence, and it is scary,
yeah.
And it is dangerous.
And people are texting because
right.
It's so important to text this out and let the other one know what you're thinking. You know, is that so urgent?
No, most of the times it is not. And I think just people are having a hard time staying focused. There's too much information out there. There's too many things to get you off of your path. And I think a lot of times if people would just slow down a little bit, take some deep breaths. For me, that's like a momentary meditation. Can you talk about meditation a little bit?
It's a tool. Of course, meditation is not exclusively Buddhist. I think a lot of traditions and faiths, they also have their own way of meditating, and every way helps. It's a tool. It's a tool to help us calm down. So it's something that can kind of clear our mind better. And if we can, you know, in Buddhism, we also talk about Zen or Chan. Actually, Zen in Buddhism came from Chinese Chan, but it's the same thing. It's the state of mind that you're focused, you're clear-minded, you're aware and mindful. So if you can bring that, you know, it's not that you only have Zen or Chan when you're meditating, when you're in a certain state. Actually, you know, in our everyday life, when we know what we're doing, when we are aware of what we're thinking and saying, that would help us a lot. That would help us to be calm, to be steady. And again, like I said, you know, you make a much better decision in whatever we're doing.
Right. Across the board. Definitely,
right.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
So what kind of meditation practices do you teach at the temple?
Well, we do have classes, of course, every Sunday in the morning. We have yoga with advanced meditation. In the afternoon, we have like a beginner's class meditation. But basically, I think even for long-time meditators, the simplest way is to learn to count our breath. It's like you watch our breath, inhaling and exhaling, and you learn to count them, and you just focus on that. And for some long-time meditators, they may, you know, when it's like, you know, a jug of muddy water. When you put it down, you know, because all the time we're shaking it, so it's always muddy. So mm-hmm. it's like our mind. Our mind is always agitated. We're always shaking this bottle of muddy water. But if you put it down, let it rest, then you can see, oh, mind, there's a lot of dirt. Oh, there's a little pebble down there. Oh, you know, there's whatever's down there. There's a dead leaf down there. Uh-huh. So it's like, then you also see the clear water. The clear water is like our wisdom that is always there. But we don't see it because we're always shaking the bottle. We're always agitating our mind. Mm-hmm. And so when you see that pebble, when you see that mud, that sand, you may like it, but let it go. So all those things are like our negative thoughts, our negative experiences, whatever. And you just let it go. And you just let it be. And you just observe it. You just watch it calm down. So if the mind is calm and settled, we have all the wisdom that we can use and make, you know, again, back to making good decisions.
Right. And it comes back to that curiosity about how your mind works and the thoughts that appear out of nowhere, the feelings that you have in your, you know, instead of, you know, judging them, you can sit there and say, that's interesting.
Just watch it. And just let it go. And, or, you know, you may see things you like. It's like, oh, actually, there's a big pearl or a big diamond in that water there. Oh, you may be so happy. You love it. You say, oh, I found a jewel. But it's like, you know, when you're meditating, you have very good scenes. You have very happy joyfulness, happy feelings, happy states. And you still just let it go. And you know, then I would say that, you know, one day you'll be enlightened.
Yes, hopefully. In this lifetime.
This is what we're all looking for.
Exactly. So can you talk a little bit about attachment? I think that's a huge concept in Buddhism. And you were talking a bit about it before.
Right. Well, attachment is something. Sometimes it's not all positive things, of course. You know, a lot of times we cannot let go of our anger, the pain, the sorrow, or we cannot let go of losses, of course, you know, material things, loss of a loved one, mm-hmm. the loss of relationships. And it can get very complicated. It's, of course, if you lose a loved one, it's a lot harder than say, I lost my credit card. It can be a lot of trouble, but it's not as painful. Mm-hmm. Or maybe for some people, it's the other way around. I don't know. So, you know, for letting go or attachment, letting go of our attachments, it's something that we really have to practice. Like I said earlier on, causes and conditions. We kind of have this person or have this situation or have this object because of certain conditions coming together. I mean, it's like you own a beautiful car, or your dream car. You bought your dream car, but as you drive it, use it, it may not be as beautiful. It may not run as well as you think it would be. And then what? You know, so you still have to use it in a sense. But of course, you know, a lot of people would try their best to get rid of it and then buy another new car. And then you go through the cycle again. Mm-hmm. So, you know, this is sometimes you say it's like living and dying. You know, you just go in and out the whole time. And we don't learn, you know. But if you say, hey, you know, it's okay. You know, I can maybe use something that is not as dreamlike, or that I can live with my used car. I can still, you know. So depending on your perspective and depending on your priorities. But in any situation, is to see through the reality of it. We have this experience, we have this particular object or this possession that we have because of certain conditions. And over time, I mean, it's like this body of ours. We don't want to get old, but we still get old. We don't want to get sick, we still get sick. And ultimately, who wants to die? We still die. Nobody right. wants to die. So it's the same. It applies to everything because, you know, things just keep changing. It's beyond our control. However, we just learn to live with it. We learn to use it. We learn to cherish whatever we have. And if it's no longer with us, you know, it's just we're grateful. We're grateful for having it. We're grateful for to learn from this experience, and we can move on, and we can be much happier.
That's a beautiful way of stating it. And, you know, as for me with attachments, I think my hardest attachment is letting certain people go. When you know that the...
I think that should be the hardest as humans.
Yeah.
And we are all humans. I think that is the hardest. That is the really hard part for a lot of people.
It is. You know, and even like some of my therapy clients, I think back about how they grew just for the short amount of time that I was with them and just what they brought to the table. And one of my supervisors had said, I learn every time I'm with a client. And I thought that is a great statement. And that would be wonderful if we could have that experience with people that we're close to, or just, you know, family, friends, loved ones. Just learn what you can from the experience and be grateful. Be grateful for the experience, whether it's good or bad. It's all a learning process.
Exactly, because learning is something that we should be more proactive about. You know, it's not that, I cannot help it, so I just have to do it. You know, but it's that like, open up your minds, open up your hearts, and take it as every day, every moment is a learning experience, because life should be a nonstop learning for us.
Mm-hmm.
And this is how we can mature and grow and develop and be a better person, I mean, for ourselves and for others. So if we can learn from this experience and, of course, gratitude, if we are grateful, I mean, whether it's a good experience, a bad experience, we still learn something from it. And be grateful that, you know, you're still here. I can still move. I can still grow. I can still live. I can still grow. I can still do things. I can still contribute and help whatever there is. And this is something that we should always be grateful about.
Yeah, and it is a gift. Life is such a gift.
Yes. We always say that when we go to bed at night, we don't know when tomorrow we can still sit up and put the shoes on again. So every day is a day that we should be grateful for.
I agree, most definitely. And we forget that. You know, again, we get consumed with what's going on and forget the meaning and the essence of being totally alive.
Mm-hmm. That's so true. I mean, a lot of people forget, or they're so tired of living, or they just cannot deal with life. It's really sad because, of course, they are very tough situations. I'm not saying that or dismissing that, but I think that we have to be grateful that we are alive. We can still see what's going on in the world. Every day, there's something new to learn.
I agree. So within the Buddhist teachings, how do they approach the concept of hope?
Well, there's hope because of actually impermanence. Impermanence, of course, is another concept in Buddhism. Because of impermanence, there's hope. I'm very poor, or I'm sick, or whatever. There may be hope for me to get well. Then, if I work hard, I can lift myself out of poverty. Or it's just the things cannot be bad forever or be negative forever.
Mm-hmm.
So there's hope. There's because of permanence. There's hope. There's a new day. There may be a new opportunity. As long as we keep going, we take the right direction. We work for it. Of course, if we have a goal, it will help. If we have wishes or we have a vow, it will help give us strength. But I would say impermanence is not all negative. Sometimes people look at karma or impermanence as very negative, but actually it's not. Karma can be good karma. Karma can be what we call neutral karma. And, of course, impermanence can be both ways. Good things don't last forever.
Mm-hmm.
Same with bad things. So, there's always hope. There's always hope that we can change for the better.
Yes, and everything is temporary. And I think some people have the concept of once I get something, I'm going to have it forever. It's, you know.
I think that's a major misconception. I mean, of course, depending on how you interpret temporary or permanent, but temporary can be a flash, can be a couple of years, can be 10 years. You know, if you really step back, you know, temporary is, can be a blimp, even our lives. What is 100 years? Even if we live to 100, I mean, it's been centuries and millenniums, you know, since we know the universe, let's say, or this country or this world. So, you know, what is 100 years?
It is. It's a blink. It's a blink.
Yeah, it's a blink. It's a blink.
So yeah. What do you think one of the most profound and ageless lessons in Buddhism is?
I would say we still go back to the core, is what we call, I mentioned much earlier on, the dependent origination. If we recognize that nothing comes out all by itself, because it takes more than one cause for something to happen, and because this is like a combination, you know, combinations don't always last forever. So when the combination started to fall apart, starting to kind of, you know, go away, they disappear, they're not doing as well, then, you know, this phenomenon is not going to happen anymore. So if we learn that, and then because things come together of from different causes and conditions, then we can understand that we're all connected. Everything is connected in one way or another. So when we have like a sip of water, we have recognized, where did this water come from?
Mm-hmm.
And you know, we would be so much more grateful for whatever we have. We would cherish our resources so much better.
And I think too, also, you know, people who are feeling lonely and alone, if they just realize that they are connected within that web, if you would call it that. But, mm-hmm. you know, I think that would be comforting for somebody that's in that situation.
Well, yes. A lot of people, they want to cut themselves off in certain situations. But that is not something they should do, because it is not good for them in any way. You know, they should reach out. They should step out and just kind of reconnect in a sense, or make new connections, because actually we are already connected. They may not realize it.
Yeah, and
it may be a little difficult for a lot of people, but if you're willing to take that step, that first step or the second step, there will be many, many steps, and you can go down different paths, and you can meet different people, and you can come across different situations. And there'll be a lot of conditions out there that may help us.
Right, and then you're not alone anymore.
And then you will not be alone anymore.
Exactly. Yeah, I think a lot of people need that now. I think a lot of people are feeling disconnected. I think a lot of people are starting to shelter themselves off more in their homes and not going out and connecting with other people, like in the evening.
With the smartphone, they connect with the internet, but that is not a real connection in a sense. Of course, you can do that. That's only one of the tools, one of the ways, but that's not the only way for sure.
Yes, definitely. And can you tell the listeners a little bit about the Eightfold Path?
The Eightfold Path, actually, it's one of the Four Noble Truths. Should I go back a little bit? The Four Noble Truths of Buddhism. The first is suffering. Actually, it's a very bad translation of dukkha. Suffering means unsatisfactoriness. Things just cannot be satisfactory for the long term. And then, of course, there's a cause for it. So we look at the cause for our so-called suffering. And then you want to end this cause. When the causes of all suffering are ceased, or always a cessation, that's what we call nirvana. You know, that's the best state, because there's non-duality. You won't be suffering, and you would be in this complete, total tranquility. And finally, the fourth one is the path. the way for cessation of all of this suffering and the causes. And the first one, of course, the Noble Eightfold Path, is it always begin with the word right. So we must have a right view, and the right view is to look at things in the right perspective, right view and right understanding, okay, of what is going on. So it's just if I go through it one by one, it may be a little, you know, cumbersome here on the radio show. So it's like if we have good focus, if we have good perspective, then we can make the right decision. And then, of course, it's what we see, what our thoughts are, and then we can progress to, like, right speech. We would do the right, we would say the right things, and then right action, then we do the right things. We would not be misconducting in any ways. And to kind of explore that a little further is that we would, what we call the right livelihood, is that, you know, we would choose a career or work that would be, of course, it would make us make a living, is in plain terms is just to make money, but it's like in the right way, in a lawful way. And then when we, so, and then if you go on further, is we can practice well, of course, in Buddhism we say we have to practice, we have to kind of perfect ourselves, in a sense, is to keep doing goodness. So you have to be diligent, you have to work hard at it. And then finally, we say that because we apply diligence consistently, we would be very focused and we would have right concentration, and then we would be enlightened. So that is the path to enlightenment, actually. So it's like it would touch on every aspect of our lives, and it would touch on, like, how we conduct ourselves and what we do, what we speak, and what we think. So, but it all starts with having the right view. So we must have the right perspective.
Yes, most definitely. And sometimes that's hard to get to. You know, sometimes it takes a little trial and error, wouldn't you say?
Yes. Yes. But then if we are calm enough, you know, we can think better. We can take a step back. We can look at, reflect on it, and maybe, oh, you know, I could come a little further to the center, or go a little right or left or whatever. And then we can still be on the path.
Yes. Staying on the path. That's always a challenge. So, Venerable...
Well,
go ahead.
No, I think that I was going to say this is modern life.
Yes, this is modern life, most definitely. So, does practicing Buddhism take a lot of discipline?
Well, because I talked about being responsible. So when we are responsible for ourselves, if we are responsible for people or for our family, you know, for at work or whatever, in school and our lives in general, that means discipline. That's true. It's discipline. You know, it's learn to. Buddhism, you know, what we call the basic five precepts, is to, we make the vow to refrain from doing a few things, like refrain from killing, refrain from stealing, to refrain from lying, and then refrain from having sexual misconduct, and to refrain from taking intoxicants. The last one being, because when our mind it's intoxicated, when our mind is really under the influence, we will not be making right choices. We will be doing all the wrong things that we mentioned earlier on. We will kill, we will steal, we lie, we do a lot of things that we shouldn't do in the first place. So that's discipline for a lot of people. But people, you know, oh, those are things that bound me, those are things that kind of tie me up. That's not true. It's like providing the right path, the right guidelines. You know, it's not. It's like the train going on the rail. You know, if it's not going on the right rail, it derail, and it would cause a lot of trouble. It would be very, very dangerous. So we have to look at it from another perspective. Discipline is not things that kind of tied us up or bound us, but actually, it's actually providing us the fastest and the correct, the right path in life.
Yeah, and it's given us boundaries that we can flourish in.
Exactly. We say that the violation of the five precepts end up having us end up in prison. And that's when we lost our freedom, that we are truly bound, we are truly restricted.
Right, so it comes down again to self-responsibility.
Yes.
Yes. If any of the listeners would like to visit the temple in Hacienda Heights, do you have that address?
It's 3456 Glenmark, G-L-E-N-M-A-R-K, Glenmark Drive, Hacienda Heights. And the code, the zip code is 91745.
And it's very
easy to find us on Google. Very easy.
Yeah, it's very easy to get off of. It's off of the 60 freeway and taking Hacienda Heights Boulevard. And just to go up there and explore the temple and the grounds is just magnificent. And they have a museum and a lovely vegetarian restaurant and a tea room. And it's really comforting to go up to. It's peaceful. People are friendly. And I love going up there just to, you know, sit with friends and meditate and, you know, sit in the temple and listen to the chanting. I try to do the chanting. Sometimes I can follow along. Sometimes I can't. So. But trying.
You can just sit in and take in the energy. I think it's something that a lot of people may do. They whether they are Chinese or not, I mean, whether they can follow or not, sometimes people just want to sit there and just absorb, you know, the energy of the chanting.
Yes. And when are the English Buddhism classes held?
Also on Sunday at 10:30. Actually, we have two classes. One, what we call the core teachings, and the other is more advanced, what we call the sutra study. And there are also smaller study groups afterwards. We have to check with the instructor on, you know, which group you'd like to join. And, of course, the meditation instructions in the morning. There's a yoga to go with it, and it's at 8:30, yoga, and then meditation at 9:20, and about 15 minutes, and there's we'll take a short break, and 10:30 will be the classes. And in the afternoon, we have, like, a beginner's meditation that starts at 2 and ends at 3, so it's, like, 1 hour.
Okay, and can you give the listeners the website for the temple?
Oh, www.hsilaishilai, that is .org, and you can also email us with questions that you may have. There will be info at IBPS. IBPS stands for International Buddhist Progress Society, so IBPS.org.
Wonderful.
And we also have Facebook.
Yeah.
We also have Facebook. Of course, our website, there's a Facebook. There's just Shilai Temple. I think it's easily I don't know exact numbers. I think it's 5,000 plus. I don't remember exact numbers at this point. And, of course, we can always have more likes.
Yes. You have international friends. How much better can that be?
Really.
So, Venerable Miao Shi, thank you so much for being on Psych 101 this evening.
Oh, it's a pleasure. And I look forward to see you again, Julianne.
Thank you. Amitofu.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And if you would like to contact me, my business number is 562-234-4650. I'm at jgoode8, that's JGOODE8, at verizon.net. I'm also on Facebook and Twitter, so contact me. I would love to hear from you. Give me what your opinion is. Let me know if you have an idea for an upcoming show. And if you would also like to tap into past shows, you can do so at the iTunes Store under podcast. It's Psych 101, PSYCH, the number 1, O-N, another number 1. So contact me. I would love to hear from you. And take good care of yourselves. That is so important. Go out and pursue your dreams. They are obtainable. Believe me, whatever gets in your way is just temporary. So thank you so much for listening to me. This has been Julianne Good for Psych 101. Take care.